Morning, everyone. My name is Annie Hawkins, and I work for the New England Fishery Management Council. And on behalf of Rick Cummingham and Paul Howard and the council, I thank you all for being here and welcome you to Portland. I know a lot of you have traveled really far in order to share your experiences with sectors, with the council, and with the other participants here. And it's going to be some very valuable input for the council to consider when thinking about possible improvements to the sector management program. Going to turn the mic over to our chair, Rip Cunningham, for a welcome, and then I'll go over the details of the agenda and the format of the workshop with you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm glad to see we're not overspending for podiums here today. I want to add, on behalf of the council, my welcome to everybody who has come to help us work on sector management. I also wanted to thank the staff. These kinds of events don't get organized on their own, and the staff has put in a lot of time working on it, and in particular, Annie, for all of your work in organizing it. I expect, and in fact, we asked for people to come to give us the good, the bad, and the ugly with sector management. But what I would like to see as an outcome at the end of the 2 days is a list of items that the council can work on as quickly as we can to help improve sector management. That's why we're here today, although I expect to get a very broad range of input on how sectors have operated over this first year. Quickly, thanks again for everyone for your participation, coming today, taking time out of your schedule to help the council work on improving sector management.
I did want to take a minute to go over the agenda and the format of the workshop. We have 140 people that registered for the workshop, and a lot to do in a relatively short amount of time. So just to be clear what's going on and to clear up any questions in advance before we get started here. And this morning, we're going to hear some analytical presentations from council staff, from Northeast Fisheries Science Center staff, and from the Northeast Regional Office of the National Marine Fisheries Service. There was one slight change in the agenda from the earlier draft that went out. An earlier agenda had an additional presentation on a break-even analysis of sectors that was a joint work, and that wasn't, unfortunately, ready to go today, so we removed that from the agenda and have a little bit more time for the other presentations this morning. After lunch today, we'll have a public comment session, and then we'll start with our sector presentations. And the way that those are going to work is that we have panels for each of six different topics that are made up of sector managers and fishermen from each sector. So we have six different issues that they're going to cover, and they're going to sit up here and present in panels. After those are done, after lunch tomorrow, we'll have breakout sessions. And everybody who's in attendance can participate in the breakout sessions, although it's not required. But we do ask that you attend those and give your input. Those will be just over 2 hours long. We're going to have five breakout groups, and they're going to be in the back of the room. We've got four big tables now, but tomorrow there will be a fifth for the fifth breakout group. I hope everyone checked in at the registration table when they got here. For everyone that let us know they were coming in advance, you have a printed name tag. And if you don't, please let Joan in the hallway know that you're here so we can let everyone know your name and give you a breakout group, even if you're not sure if you're going to participate in those. And then at the end of the day tomorrow, we'll report out from the breakout groups and summarize the findings. And we'll have a little bit more information when the breakout groups get closer about how those are going to operate. In the meantime, I just want to reiterate that we do have a fairly long lunch break today. We have it scheduled for an hour and a half, maybe a little more, and tomorrow an hour and 15 minutes. We do ask that you come back from lunch promptly, especially tomorrow when the breakout groups start right after lunch. It would be really great if everyone could be back here and get started. I know that there's a lot of really good lunch options in Portland, but we try to be punctual here so that we don't end up going very late both days. So With that, one more thing. After each of the presentations and the panel discussions, we are going to take questions from the audience. Anyone that's in the audience is free to ask questions. It's not limited to council members. We ask that if you want to share your opinion or your experience with sectors, that you do that during the public comment session and not during the panel sessions or during the presentations, just because we are very pressed for time and we do want to hear everyone's experiences. But the panels are large. Most of the panels have about 8 or 10 people in them, and so we want to make sure that everyone on the panels gets a chance to speak. And so so I will cut you off if you talk too long. Don't take it personally. and just be respectful so that everyone gets a chance to speak. So are there any questions about the format of the workshop before we get started? All right, great. In that case, I'm going to introduce Drew Kitts from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, Social Sciences Branch. The presentation on the first year of sector implementation, Drew gave us a presentation at the September Council meeting about how sectors had performed the first year, and this is an update of that report with additional information. And I'll turn it over. And one more thing, the internet access code is Pumpkin88, if anyone needs it.
Oh, yeah, that would help. And so this is what I'm going to present today is the final version of a three-series report that started with looking at what happened at the nine-month point. And then towards the end of September, I presented the results of the annual report. And this report actually contains some additional analyses that weren't included, but it's still the year-end report for 2010. We had hoped to release this report yesterday, but there were some unexpected delays in doing that, so I apologize for that we don't have paper copies of the report or hasn't been up on the website, but that will be posted today around 11 o'clock. And so I am here for the entire workshop. If you get a chance to read the report later this afternoon or tonight and have some additional questions, I will be around tomorrow to help address any of those questions. But so apologize for not having that out ahead of the workshop. But so anyway, we'll just treat this as just a little preview. And since I recently presented the year-end results not too long ago, I'm not going to focus on sort of the core information. I'm just going to focus on the new things that are in this report. However, this report will be a standalone document. It will have everything in it, so you don't necessarily, if you've had previous copies, don't necessarily need to hang on to those. Everything will be in the one document. Next slide. Okay. So these are the new analyses that went into the report, which I'll certainly go into more detail. But overall, there was some more. The biggest piece is really the look at the annual catch entitlement leasing and some descriptive information and statistics about what happened in that market. There's new information on looking at owners' net revenue. It gets us a little closer to a picture of profitability, whereas in the old reports, we looked at things like revenue per trip and per day. We have a new analysis on vessel productivity, and I'll explain soon what that actually means. And we also did some new analyses that looked at what's happening in a lot of the measures in the last report at the owner level, whereas everything else prior to this was at the vessel level. And so we have some additional information that shows, gives us some sense of vessel ownership groups, and then how these things like consolidation and landings and revenue and net revenue play out at that level. Oops, if you can go back one. Okay. So just to quickly summarize the major findings in this new report, there were 22 million pounds of ACE that were transferred in 2010, and that's at an estimated value of $13.5 million. The other thing that was new in this report is the net revenue figures sort of confirmed the approaches that we used earlier, where we looked at revenue per trip and per day and saw some increases in 2010. So that is consistent with what we were finding earlier. The productivity measures show difference in over the time, the four-year time horizon, difference between sector and common pool vessels, and I'll get into some more detail about that. And also saw a continuing trend in the concentration of ground fish revenue at both the vessel level and at the owner level, but this was less pronounced at when you look at total revenue. And again, I'll be going through all these in more detail. Before doing that, though, I just wanted to give a little bit of historical perspective. And this is a graph that's just their index values for ground fish value, weight, and number of permits in the fishery since 2001. And while this report just looks at the last 4 years from 2007 through 2010, we wanted to provide this graph to kind of put it in a longer time frame. And the point here is really that the amount landed and the value and the number of vessels in this fishery has been declining for the last decade. But I'm going to zero in on just the last 4 years. So here I want to talk about the net revenue analysis. And before I present those results, I want to make sure that we all understand what I'm talking about when I talk about the owner's share of net revenue. I'm sure many of you, this is not news, but understand how vessels typically pay their crew. They use the firm, but let me just briefly go over in case there are some people that don't follow how this happens. So starting out at the trip level, they're from the sale of fish, there are gross revenues, and typically what happens is the trip costs, things like fuel, oil, ice, those types of expenses that are at the trip level are subtracted off of gross revenue to get down to the net revenue down here at the trip level. In our analysis, we had, this is data from the Observer program where we get a trip level information on how much was spent on fuel, oil, and ice. I have ACE and days at sea purchased here. That was not included in our analysis. This was just an example of what might happen. So this part is not included because we just don't have the data at that level to do this. And we'll sort of deal with that separately. So then what usually happens is the net trip revenue is then split between the crew and the owner. And these percentages can vary from vessel to vessel, different regions. But we just chose a 50-50 split. And so the point is what the analysis in this new report is going to show is we're just focusing on the owner share of this net trip revenue. Now, there's certainly what happens to eventually get to financial profit at the end of the year, you sum up all of the owner share from each of these trips, and then you would subtract off annual costs like insurance payments, repair and maintenance, those kinds of things, which eventually get you down to financial profit at the end of the year. And then if there was any revenue from the sale of ACE or days at sea, that would factor in here. But the data is just not complete enough for us to really get down to this, this annual financial profit at the end of the year. And we're working on improving those data. That's ultimately the goal that we want to get to understand that, or at least be able to estimate it. But for now, for this report, we're just focusing on the owner's share of net revenue. And one point I should make included in the owner's share in 2010, there was from the annual sector reports, it was reported that on average about 4 cents a pound of landed groundfish were paid to the sector for organizational fees. So that cost is included in the 2010 figures. So if we go to the next slide, please. So here are the results of the owner's net revenue broken out by the different vessel size categories. And this is similar to, if you saw the prior presentations, to the revenue per trip and revenue per day figures, where we get, in most categories, an upturn in 2010. The smaller vessel size category of less than 30 feet, you know, pretty flat, you know, little drop off here. But the thing to keep in mind is there's actually very little fishing activity in this category. A lot of these are small skiffs that were obtained for the fishing history. It's likely that a lot of ace was probably sold from that vessel category, but I'll get into a little more detail further on about the level of activity in that size category. Next slide. Oh, and sorry, could you go back one slide? I just want to point out that these are the average net revenue per day, and this is on groundfish trips. The next slide is going to show what it is on non-groundfish trips. If you could advance it once, please. Okay. And here we see on the non-groundfish trips, we get similar rise in 2010 in all these vessel size categories. Next slide. What this slide shows is since we did the analysis at the trip level, if you aggregate up across all of the trips in the database, the estimates of owner share of net revenue, and then aggregate that up for every vessel in that size category, we get this graph, which shows the aggregate amount for that class of vessels of the net revenue estimate. And here we have the first 4 years, 2007 through 2010. And then what's on this graph is another value for 2010. And what that includes is if sectors were to have paid for at-sea monitoring or dockside monitoring, this is the aggregate effect on that size category. You see that there would have been, in each category, the difference between 2010 without at-sea monitoring costs and 2010 with, in all instances, there's a drop-off in, obviously, because they have to pay that extra cost. The drop-off in the 50 to 75 category range is about 6%, and in the 75-foot and greater category, about 5%. The other thing we did is looked at trip costs as a percent of revenue, and when you factor in the at-sea and dockside monitoring costs, it increases that percentage from somewhere in the order of 35%, another additional 2 to 4% increase in the percentage of trip costs as a percent of revenue. So anyway, this was, obviously in 2010, the sectors did not have to pay those costs, and just recently was announced that the agency was going to cover that for another year. But this just helps give a perspective of down the road what the impact might be under 2010 conditions if vessels were to have to cover those monitoring costs. Next slide. So this graph shows the results of the vessel productivity analysis, and what this index shows is this is just a comparison of the physical inputs into producing fish, things like the size of the vessel, the amount of time spent at sea, the number of crew used. It's a ratio of the quantity of the inputs with the quantity of the outputs, being fish in this case. And the real message here is that from 2007 is the base year, and that starts at a value of 1. And for sector vessels, from 2007 to 2010, there was this slight increase in vessel productivity, just simply measured in physical inputs versus outputs. For common pool vessels, the trend was a downward trend. Now, this is the only measure that we actually put vessels into the sector versus common pool category. Everything else in the report just treats 2007 through 2009 as just one aggregate level. But this is the one measure that sort of goes back through time and pulls vessels into different categories. So, as I mentioned, the main thing is to show that these are different vessels for a variety of different reasons. There's this increase in that the sector vessels have higher levels of productivity than the common pool. And this actually, when you look at the in the report, you'll see some information about the average trip costs, and they actually stayed relatively stable, even though net revenues were increasing. And what some other studies have shown is in catch-share fisheries, a lot of the increase in net revenue it is through higher values, through higher prices that they're able to receive, and not so much in changes in productivity and efficiency. So this is consistent with what we're finding in the analysis of the trip costs. So now I'm going to move on to discussing the amount of trades and the work that we did on the ACE market. And what this shows is, this is all for 2010, obviously, but there was 171 million pounds of ACE that was allocated to all vessels. And now, clearly, this is all ACE combined, so about 70 million was haddock alone. But if you say, let's just look at this bottom bar for now, this is just all of the ACE, combined ACE allocated to sectors. 22 million of that, which is the blue and the yellow bars here, is what was traded. And within that, two-thirds of that 22 million was traded between sectors. So one sector trading ACE with another. And then the other third was within the sector itself. So this just helps put a little bit of perspective on relative level of trading that occurred. And again, the total value is 13.5 million. But as I mentioned before, we also had some additional information on what we're calling vessel affiliations, and it's just groups of vessels that are grouped together based on data that we have about common ownership. So if you look at the 171 million that was allocated, again, 22 million was traded of that 171. About half of that occurred within these vessel affiliations, within these groups. So, if there's one example would be one owner who has three vessels, we're calling that a vessel affiliation. So if they sort of internally transferred ACE from one boat to another, that would fall into that category. So about half was between vessel affiliations or within vessel affiliations, and the other half between vessel affiliations. Next slide. Now, what this graph shows is, again, that same 171 million pounds of ACE that was allocated to, and this is just sector vessels now, and how this breaks out by the different vessel size categories. And the blue bars show the amount that was allocated and then actually caught by sector vessels. The yellow is what was allocated and left uncaught or potentially, you know, leased out or just left on the table. We can't really tell. We don't. The data is not fine enough for us to tease that part out enough. But this shows, you know, that there's clearly this shift, particularly down at the vessels that are less than 30 feet. And as I mentioned before, these are mostly these small skiffs that might have been obtained for the ACE and not necessarily with the intention for fishing them. There certainly were some of these vessels that were active, but it was only 11 vessels out of the 248 vessels in this category actually landed any fish. And there is a very thin bar that you can't even see of the amount that was allocated. So if you look at the vessels 75 feet and greater, in aggregate, they caught more than they allocated. So the green bar had to be quota that they leased in. So this is the net result of all the shifts, you know, between and within sectors and within vessel affiliations, and this is how it plays out in each of these vessel size categories. All right, next slide. So this slide shows this that same 171 million that was allocated and caught, but this breaks it down by the different stocks. And you know, as I'm sure many of you are aware, the lowest percentage caught, the stock with the lowest percentage caught was the haddock stocks, and the highest being that were up at 94% white hake and yellowtail. So here I want to talk a little bit about consolidation and, in particular, consolidation of revenue. And in earlier reports, we presented what happened at the vessel level and showed the number of vessels, and we measure consolidation by the number of vessels that catch different percentages of the stock. So this slide shows the number of vessels that landed 100% of all species revenue, groundfish and non-groundfish combined. And the lower bar is, actually it's a little hard to see the color. Yeah, sorry. So the top bar is the what happened at the vessel level, and we get this decline, and a very similar decline if you look at these ownership groups that we're calling vessel affiliations. So when you look at all species revenue, not much different there. But if you go to the next slide, if you look at the number of vessels that land the top 50% of the revenue, if you take everybody in the fishery and look at and stack them up highest to lowest with amount of revenue per vessel, the number of vessels that land the top 50%, you see this drop off in 2010. And sort of the take-home message here is the drop-off is more steep at the vessel level and a little less steep at the vessel affiliation level. So there does seem to be a slight difference in vessels versus owner groups. Next slide. Okay, so this is now looking just at groundfish revenue, and this is the number of vessels that land 100% of groundfish, and again we get pretty similar looking trajectory between at the vessel level and at the vessel affiliation level. And if you go to the next slide, this is the number of vessels landing the top 50% of the groundfish, and here's where you get more of a picture where at the vessel level you get this steeper decline between 2009 and 2010, where you don't get as steep of a decrease at the owner level. So, what does that tell us? I mean, it's sort of what I was talking about before. Some of what's happening in the fishery, if you just look at the vessel level, some of what's happening is occurring sort of within these vessel groups. And I think it's an important distinction to make. All right, a few slides left, and here I want to talk a little bit about the distribution of revenue. And I'm not going to spend too much time on that. This is just a sample graph just to give you a little bit of understanding about what I'm going to talk about in the next couple graphs. This actually isn't in your packet. I see a lot of people looking around for this graph. But what this shows is if you, again, were to take every vessel and rank the landings, the revenue from low to high, if everybody caught exactly the same amount of fish, if this 45 degree line, you would have the first 10% getting revenue, 10% of the revenue. So what I'm going to talk about next is something called a Gini coefficient. And really why I wanted to just show you this graph is the Gini coefficient just measures the area between that 45 degree line and these actual and the actual curves that you see. So what you're seeing in this curve is the 2007, 8, and 9, they're all grouped together with the red, yellow, and green line. But then when you looked at 2010, this is with groundfish revenue distribution, there was this shift in vessel affiliations to 2010. So I just wanted to give you that mental picture. It'll be a little easier to look at the next few slides to understand what's going on. So these show the Gini coefficients, and a Gini coefficient of 1 means that it's completely the extreme end of one person landing all of the revenue, where a Gini coefficient of 0 would be that 45-degree line. It would be if everybody caught the same exact amount. So the one thing to note here is the scale on this starts at 0.5, so all these slides are going to be at least above 0.5. And we get if we look at the this is vessels and vessel affiliations, the change in the Gini coefficient, we get this upturn in 2010, pretty similar between vessels and vessel affiliations. And if you go to the next slide after that, this is the Gini coefficient for just groundfish revenue alone. And again, we're here, we're already starting at values of 0.65 and 0.75. And then when you go into 2010, for vessel affiliations, we're up at a value of 0.85. So, the closer we keep getting to that value of 1 shows, this increased trend towards more concentration of groundfish revenue among fewer vessels. And then lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about the non-groundfish landings and revenue that occurred in these this analysis of limited access groundfish vessels. And we can see, scallops has always been an important component. This is the top 10 non-groundfish species. This is and according to revenue for the vessels that were in this analysis. The main point here is, there was this upturn in 2010 in scallop revenue, in lobster, loligo, and fluke. And if we look at the next slide, the one thing that's a little bit interesting about this is this is the landings in millions for those same species. And if you remember from the last slide, the scallop revenue went up pretty dramatically, but the actual landings dropped. So that increase in revenue was entirely to higher prices for scallop. Lobster and loligo, there was a small increase in landings of those species with higher revenue, so prices were the biggest part of that explanation. And then fluke, both revenue and landings increased, and that can be seen in this graph. So just to finish up, the next steps for us in the social science end of things is to continue to report on these kinds of things, establish a series of reports for all catch share fisheries. We want to continue to evaluate groundfish, and we have some plans for doing that over the next few years. We want to continue to refine the performance measures that we use in these types of reports, try and get better information. And along with that, in order to do that, we really need to improve the data that we have available to do that. And I wanted to end with, at the last presentation, Dave Pierce asked what types of information, what could the council do to help further this process along. And sort of to answer Dr. Pierce's question, there's really three things. The biggest thing that we lack information on is about what's happening to crew. We really don't know exactly how many there are, how they move among fisheries and vessels. And while we do have some measures in the report that show the opportunities for crew, there's been changes with vessels dropping and the amount of effort that they could be impacted. But we really can't say how many jobs might have been lost or how that has changed. So we really do need some more information on crew. There are a couple of new surveys that will be coming over the next year. There will be a survey of vessel owners and crew and some surveys about costs. And we really need high participation in those, and you will be hearing a lot more about those. Over the next year, we'll have some outreach, but to the extent that the council can encourage participation in those surveys will really help us to do a better job with these types of reports. And also, this is our first experience with dealing with the ACE trading data, and we like to just continue to try and push for more clarity about that data. And make sure that's in the best shape as we can get. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions about the presentation. Good. Sure.
We have mics.
Okay.
Thanks. I'm Hank Sullivan, the manager of the Sustainable Harvest Sector. I've got a few questions, some of which I'll maybe refer to your slides up on the screen here, but
sure.
One about a prior report. My first question is, I think that you mentioned that sector costs average about 4 cents per landed pound, sector operation costs.
Right.
And so what was the aggregate figure, 4 cents times how many members?
I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to go.
Tom, do you recall?
Landed pounds?
I don't recall. Okay.
I might be able to get that answer for you real quick. In 2010, landed ground fish pounds was 58 million.
So that's about $2.3 million or something like that,
right,
according to my math and operating costs for sectors. Okay,
right.
I just want to clarify that.
Right.
In one of the earlier slides, you indicated sort of a flow of funds in the settlement on a typical trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that you had ACE leasing costs or David T leasing costs probably historically as coming off the top on the settlement. Is that generally the case that you found, or did you find cases where owners were paying for that?
We don't have clear data on that. I've heard that can happen, that crew can be charged for days at sea or ACE. I just put that up as an example of a place that expense could possibly go. It could have been just covered by the vessel, but that.
From the questions that the observers
asked. Right. Yeah, we don't ask that question. Yeah.
Do you have any sense for the pattern of revenue for crew members themselves? You talk about owner revenues a little bit.
Well, we don't, and that's really the hard part. I mean, since we use that assumption of the 50-50 split,
yeah,
in this analysis anyway, if you look at the aggregate owner share, in aggregate the crew is going to be the same. But that's all we can really say at this point. But how that then gets the hard part is, crew move among different vessels, and so it's kind of hard to say sort of in the aggregate how many crew there are, and they might be working trips on different boats and things like that.
Right. You can make progress on that, or that's just going to be nebulous always.
Until we get better data, it is going to be hard to make progress on that.
Okay, now I'm going to refer to a couple of slides. You can scroll back to them if you like.
Okay.
The first one is on slide 10, where we were talking about ACE trading.
Mm-hmm.
Try slide, okay, at the top. It says the value of transfers is $13.5 million, which was all transfers or just between the sectors?
That was all, but we used primarily the between sector prices that were recorded, and Chad can jump in and help me out on this if I mess this up. But in the between sector transfer data, there were actual prices of 1,000 pounds of cod for X dollars, but there was also a lot of groups of species lumped together that were traded for other groups. And he used a method to tease out what the values of those swaps were, and was able to get an actual estimated value for each species. It is using all of the transfer data, but using where there was a dollar value recorded, sort of getting the estimated out of that.
That's what I want to follow up on. So the value there includes a misimputation of the value of those fish swaps, because I think that dwarfish was swapped and was actually traded for cash. And it was probably pretty close, at least in my sector.
Right. So, this is the estimated value of all the trades that occur, even if they were swaps. We assigned a value to the
gray sole for cod, for instance.
Right.
You did something like take the average value of gray sole and assign that value to that swap.
Right. Yes. Chad's shaking his head. Yes. Yeah.
That's why I wanted to clarify.
Okay.
The next slide on slide 11 talks about, it's not a slide 11. It's just 10 or 11. It talks about swaps to yourself, or transfers to yourself. And I thought when I heard you say was that within the big databases that you all submitted, that you saw traces of product. You're saying you saw some that went from one owner's permit A to one owner's permit B, essentially?
Right, and the other, if we could actually go back one slide, the one point that I want to make is these. I probably should have made two different graphs with this, but vessel affiliations can cross across several sectors. So this is just breaking out what the number of trades that happened within those vessel affiliations and between, and then completely separate from that is within sectors and between sectors. But the point is, in either case, some of the trading occurred either within that sector or within this owner group. And we just think it's an important distinction to make between the amount that occurred between those types of groups.
No, sure. As a sector manager, I have several owners in that sector, and one way to look at it is, if you're one of the owners, Drew, I don't care. You have three permits.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care about the amount of ACE that you have on any individual permit. It's just what you've got in total.
Right.
So within my sector, for instance, I wouldn't be transferring from your permit A to your permit B, because I really don't care. What I care is that you've got permit A, B, and C combined, and that's your pool.
Right. And it's probably not fair to characterize that as a transfer, but we're just using that terminology of it's just a difference with each of those three permits had an allocation, and if that gets reshuffled, we're sort of calling that a transfer.
And is that included in that $13.5 million?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So some amount of those transfers that you showed there were actually between an owner's permit A and an owner's permit B.
Yes, right.
And you can strip that out if need be.
I don't know if we can. Yes, we can.
Thanks. I'm getting to the end. On slide 11, I'm sure about that this time, we talk about catching excess of allocation, which is the green bar.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, off the top of your head, tell me what the majority of that catch was?
I'm going to look to Chad on that one again. Do you have an idea? No. No, sorry. This is, we'd have to go back and look at that.
Okay. that's something that could be teased out here, right?
Right. Okay. Yes.
All right, then, thanks. The last question I've got is not on this presentation, but it's one that you provided a couple of weeks ago to the council, and it's your interim report, and it talks about average revenues for crews and boats and average days at sea, that sort of thing. And I'm looking at the revenue tables for the different vessel classes, and I wish that we had this on the screen, I'm sorry. But I'm taking a look at average groundfish revenue per vessel within the category. And I can give you an example. I see a figure here of $236,000. But then I see these standard deviations, which commonly equal or exceed the value of the average. And I'm not a statistician, I don't want to be. But my question, from what little I understand about standard deviation, the bigger that is, the wider the range of data. So I'm just wondering if you could explain to me what a... Is this indeed a large standard deviation, or what that translates to in real life?
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, you are looking at it the right way. If you look at that standard deviation value, if it's large compared to the mean, if you were to add it to the mean or subtract from the mean, you would get, you know, not a minimum and a maximum, but it would give you a wider range on that data. So the larger those standard deviations are, you know, the more the distribution of the data is wider, so there's just more variability.
So it
does mean that, you know, making comparisons of the mean should be done with a little more caution with a high standard deviation than a very small standard deviation. And in this report, the net revenue analysis, the one way we've dealt with that is, and I get into any of this kind of detail here, but we used a simulation that actually selects values from distributions on trip costs and provides some confidence ranges around those means. So you get a little better feel of sort of what the range of values is around that mean. But so
can we Hank, last question, okay, and then we're gonna move on.
Pardon?
Median versus the mean, was there any significant difference?
I didn't evaluate that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Drew, of the $13.5 million that you're estimating trades to, what percentage of that, of ACE transfers, what percentage of that was actually trades that you guys put a value to? Versus what was actually dollar for dollar value transactions.
Do you have a sense of that, Chad? Maybe Chad should come up. Like I said at the beginning, this ACE trading is a new interesting part of this.
So there's a bunch of stuff going on here. The way that we calculate, and this is all made clear in the report, I hope, if we did a good job, big if, the way we calculated the intrust sector, the within sector PSC trading, is just by simply looking at the allocated ACE on a particular, or allocated PSC on a particular permit. And if you caught more than that, then that MRI had to have transferred in PSC from somewhere. So that sets a lower bound, right? It's entirely possible, in fact likely, that there was more PSC kind of swapped between sector members than was actually translated into landings. So this is a lower bound here, right? Whereas in the inter-sector trades, the data that we actually have for, you know, this sector traded with this sector, that's an upper bound because it's entirely possible, in fact it's likely, that not all of those trades were converted into landings. Right, there was probably far more, particularly for things like haddock and redfish, that were traded that were never converted into landings. So this does get a little bit wonky. As far as the prices, you know, we take the prices that we derive from the intersector and we apply those prices to the whole universe. And so those prices get a little bit wonky as well. It's unclear as to whether those are going to be biased upwards or downwards, probably a little bit upwards for the within sector trades. The $13.5 million, a lot of ACE didn't, and PSC didn't actually have a value. So haddock didn't have a value. I can't remember. There was three of the 16 of the 16, I think, didn't have any value. So a lot of higher volume trades were assumed as zero value, so that 13 is kind of a little bit low relative to the pounds that were traded. But as far as, you know, your specific question of how many pounds had prices, it's going to be pretty low, because I think that of the 600 or so trades in the intersector permit database, we were able to derive kind of valid price data from about 300.
Well, I think it's important to try to figure out, to point that out, because it's not really, I think it's misleading that $13.5 million actually changed hands. People are trading ace for ace. They're doing that just to balance their portfolios, and which is one of the design positives of the system. So I just think it's important to try to figure out that.
But it's also important to understand that those trades have values as well. I mean, somebody's giving up something and getting something, and it might be a wash to the two players, but it's a transfer, and those transfers have value.
Right. I have one other question, and I had asked this before, and when you look at the revenue increases on groundfish days, I think at some point it's really important to look at that and where it came from. You know, in other words, break out revenue increase, take out haddock, or look at least be able to break out revenue increases with redfish, haddock, and pollock. Because again, we're misleading here, that would be a way to look at that is a positive way. So a lot of the revenue increase was derived from shifting targeting to more healthier stocks, and it leads you to a different place than just saying we're getting concentrated revenue.
Right. That's a good point. Thank you.
Thank you. Going back to slide 10, it seems to be my question centers around, I'm missing something here, because I'm somehow not able to understand the distinction between the trading going on with vessel affiliations versus sector. I'm not understanding that. It would seem to me that, at least what I understand to be your explanation of vessel affiliations, that it would be far closer to what's going on, you know, with the sector. So I've got to be missing something there. And then secondly, you make the comparison using sector vessels and vessel affiliations throughout the presentation, and I'm having a hard time understanding the relevance of that. So maybe if I understand the first part.
Right. Well, I'll just review, you know, how we're defining a vessel affiliation and the data that we have to do that. And the simple example is what Hank was talking about before. If I own three vessels, it's really my ownership of those three vessels that creates this link. And so what we simply do is aggregate across those three vessels and call that a vessel affiliation. So if one vessel is in one sector and there's one in another, it's still the same vessel affiliation, even though there's two sectors. But the other way you can get vessel affiliation is if you and I jointly own a vessel, but then you also own another vessel with somebody else. We're putting those vessels in what we're calling a vessel affiliation. And this is actually something that we'll probably need to discuss with the council at some point. Is this is the first time we really have that type of ownership information. And as you start getting more complicated networks of vessels, you know, that's where you start need to make some judgment calls, you know, if you sort of go on, work on down the line with that example. At some point, you know, vessel affiliation gets to be a little bit unrealistic, but we err on the side of you know, if there was a connection of ownership in any way, we regroup those together. But it's, I guess, to answer your question, it's completely separate from where we looked at what happened within sectors, and just, you know, understand that there could be vessel affiliations that cross across different sectors. So I wouldn't, like I said, it was probably a mistake to put these two on the same chart. I should have just completed them, treated them separately.
I saw Ben in the back there, or whoever you can pick.
Thank you, Drew. What I wanted to point to is charts 6 and 7 here. And the question I had, I know at the council, one of our previous council meetings, we asked for net revenue analysis because we felt that was a very important aspect. And we did try to get at it on a per-trip basis, but in your report, you have a cumulative net revenue for by vessel class between years, and do you have it broken out also maybe by state or by sector?
Yes, yes, we do. And actually, the slide that follows where I got into talking about what the effect of at-sea monitoring would be, that is the aggregate net revenue for those different vessel classes. We also report average net revenue per vessel and have a table in there. But we do then, once we aggregate up, we do break it out by primary port and these vessel size classes. So there will be information on that.
Okay, I'll be looking forward to
it. Okay. 11 o'clock.
Thanks. Ben Martins with the Port Flight Sector. One of my questions kind of goes back to something that Hank was touching on. And I appreciate you throwing that extra spot on the graph that shows what would happen if there's at-sea monitoring had to be covered by our boats. But how much, and then we have that 4 cents fee, basically, that's an average. But how much of that is affected by the money that was put into the sectors by the federal government for the first 2 years? And how much is that going to be skewed when more sector costs have to be paid for by the sector members? Do you guys look at that at all? And, you know, how many sectors are charging or whatnot?
And are you referring to paying for at-sea monitoring and dockside monitoring, or are you referring to something else?
Oh, you know, we had that, but then we also had operation costs covered by the
okay, yeah, that. That was not included in this analysis at all. So that would change this picture here. If there were some additional costs on top of at-sea or dockside monitoring, that would be reflected in this second 2010 point on this graph.
Okay.
I find it that it's pretty much impossible that the 75 footers landed more than their allocation, and that there was that shown that 65% of all allocation goes to 30 to 50 foot vessels? Is that what that shows?
Well, it's not a percent. That the bottom line is millions of pounds, so about 40 million pounds was allocated to the less than 30 foot category. Which is 248 vessels.
In the 30 to 50s, there was 65 million pounds allocated then?
Right.
And that seems right to you?
Yes.
It doesn't.
I should point out there was, in the version you have, the paper version, there was a mistake on that 75. That line is a little larger, and I actually corrected that last night, but if you add these total bars up, it'll add up to 171 million.
Okay. How about skiffs? Where do skiffs fall into here?
In the less than 30 category. And the ratios next to the vessel size categories, the 11 over 248, there was 11 active vessels that actually had groundfish landings, a pound of groundfish landings, out of the 248 that had an allocation. So clearly the skiffs are in that category. And so, you know, that yellow area, you know, presumably a large part of that was transferred up to the other size categories.
Okay, so the problem that the New England groundfish fisheries has then, as far as harvesting side is concerned, is that the smaller boats are not catching anywhere as close to their allocation, according to these charts, right?
Right.
So do we have any ideas as to why that's happened? Or why it's not happening?
Well, I think the large part of it is, this idea of a vessel owning maybe a larger vessel and a skiff and transferring that allocation off of the smaller boat onto a large boat.
Yeah,
so I think
that'd be the under 30s, though. The 30 to 50.
Right. Oh, so what, you're talking about the 30 to 50.
Yeah, exactly. You have the largest allocation of fish and you're not catching anywhere close to it. And
right.
I'm a shoreside processor, and we'd love to see some of that fish.
Right, right.
A lot of that fish get caught. I mean, and it seems to me as something's drastically wrong if we're allocating them 65
right.
million pounds of fish and they're landing 10.
Right. Right, and I mean, and if you go back and look at various parts of the report, this 30 to 50 foot category does seem to be the one where there was some drop off in revenue and effort, and this graph shows that. I mean, if you were to focus in on the group of vessels that might be most impacted, the place to explore further is that category.
Looks like we have someone that might want to respond back there. So go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. I think that's probably skewed a lot because those smaller boats were allocated to a lot of Georgian Bank haddock and other stocks that they just don't fish for. And so, some of the larger boats can't fish for those stocks, and so they prosecute those more fully than especially the 30 to 50 foot boats. So, it's really kind of misleading to show, all that fish that was allocated to those boats that's really kind of phantom fish that they're never going to catch, and it's really worth $0 in the ACE leasing market anyway.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. We should probably produce these graphs and take the haddock out and see what the result is.
Right in the redfish. Redfish, haddock, all of those stocks that are pretty much useless.
Right.
Based on the current management rules that don't allow us to prosecute those fish at this time.
I think this has been very useful, but I'm concerned that people are going to draw conclusions about net revenue without the examination of the leased fish. And, they're going to leap to conclusions, and I can see press headlines, net revenues are up. I've drawn up a flow chart here of the cost of leased fish. And at least in our sectors, in the Gulf of Maine cod is a choke stock, and it's the highest cost of leased fish. And I'm working as an individual now, fully on leased cod, and my crew isn't even making a little more than minimum wage.
Right.
And the same with myself, because the lease cost is three quarters of the value of the cost of the trip.
Right.
So I've drawn up a flow chart here, which I'll get with you off afterwards, and show you how you might be able to look at this, how we're dealing with it anyway, how I think most
right.
people are.
Right.
But I really want to make sure people don't, go out of this room and start talking to the press and saying, oh, yeah, net revenues are up. They may be up for some people that are leasing fish that are cheap, like Georgia Bank Cat. But if you're leasing Gulf of Maine cod, and you can't leave the pier without leasing Gulf of Maine cod, and you can't in the Western Gulf of Maine,
right.
then your net revenues, once you're on these fish, are at levels approaching zero.
Right. Yeah, it's a good point, and that's part of the problem of sort of a fishery level analysis, and secondly, not having the data to be able to say at the vessel level who paid for ACE and who received money for ACE, and ideally we would work that into the analysis, which that is just not available. And then secondly, from a fishery perspective, that value of ACE, goes from one person to another. So, from a purely economic point of view, at the fishery level, it's a transfer, and those things, it's not a net cost to the fishery as a whole. Things like what we call transactions costs, if there are inefficiencies in that market or other fees are paid to brokers and things like that, that is a cost that would come out of the fishery as a whole, but the actual transfer of that is sort of a redistribution in that. But that's not to say that certain categories of vessels may be lessees of fish, and they would have differential impacts, and that certainly is the case. But again, with this type of a sort of a fishery level report it, you know, we'd have to drill down a lot further to get at that. But it is a valid point.
I think another thing we need to compare is when you lease a day at sea, lease for a boat my size, you pay about $300 for a day at sea, and you could probably catch, at least I could catch probably 3 800-pound trips of cod. Now for me, and so that was $100 a day, or $100 mm-hmm. for 800 pounds to lease that day.
Right.
Under this system, to catch 800 pounds, I'm paying over $1,000 to catch the same fish.
Right.
I'm paying $1.25 a pound for 800 pounds of cod.
Right.
So there's been, to compare, to look at the two to see where the real cost increases come.
Right.
That would be what we'll have to do to compare.
Right, and that's another good point, too. For the prior years, 2007 through 2009, any days at sea trading is not a part of this net revenue analysis either. So.
Thank
you. We have one right here, Chris.
Yes, I have a point to make, I think, to Angelo. On the vessels from 30 to 50 feet, I don't necessarily think that the fish went uncaught as much as it was leased out. A lot of vessels at that size might not have enough allocation to go catch it. And then as a point, it would be nice if you could tease out on the under 30-foot vessels how many of those permits... where that fish went. Did they go to 30-foot vessels or 50-foot or 75-foot?
Right, and yeah, we would like to be able to do that too, but that was sort of one of my last points is I think we need to continue to make improvements to this leasing data that allows us to do that.
Any more questions? We've got about 10 more minutes if anyone's got anything.
Andrew?
Josh?
Yeah. I just had one more question on graph 6, where it shows a higher average of owner's net revenue when it compares smaller vessels to larger vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a dramatic increase from larger vessels from 2009 to 2010, where the net revenue was like $2,000 and it went up to $5,000 per day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that, did you factor in a result of consolidating, four vessels into one vessel? So that, that four vessels in 2009, were basically catching the same as one vessel in 2010 because of the ability to stack permits?
No, this was all done at the vessel level. So we wouldn't have factored that.
So you didn't?
No, did not.
Okay.
No.
Could you go back to slide 11 for a minute?
Favorite slide of the day.
Yeah, I had a question about this as well. If you go and if you look at the 30 feet to 50 foot size category, a number of people have raised or focused on the allocated and uncaught. So my question is about that as well. Is it safe to assume that any allocated and uncaught fish on lower size categories, whether it's the skiff under 30 feet or the 30 to 50, that those fish could be caught in the blue bars that are represented as allocated and caught? So they'd be leased up to larger vessels?
Right, example. Right. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure some of that, yeah.
But the allocated and uncaught on the 30 to 50 foot size category there represents just sort of ballpark of 55 million pounds of fish. But most of those just simply wouldn't be caught because that you can't fit all that in some of the larger bars of
right.
allocated.
Right.
So there's simply just fish that's left on the table.
Right, and that's the part we really can't make that dividing line. We just don't have the information to tease that up.
Do we have any information about what the composition of the allocated species are for the different size categories? Or actually, maybe that's a recommendation. If you're going to represent some of the allocated and caught or allocated and uncaught by species composition. It would be helpful to do that by size category as well.
Okay. Can you flip to the next slide? Is that what you're talking about? I mean, this is the allocated and caught by stock. But maybe what you're getting at is groupings of, is that what you mean by species composition? Or does this answer your question?
I guess I'd have to spend a little bit more time looking at it to see if it answers the question. But I'm just curious why the larger vessels were so much more effective at catching their allocation, catching more than their allocation, and whether that's representative of them getting a different allocation to begin with.
Okay. Yeah, good question. I would have to look into that. Yeah.
Hey, thank you, Drew. Yeah, Drew, I'd like to go back to slides 6 and 7 again just to make a point similar to the one that was made by Doug, but you can emphasize it because these figures keep showing up and I believe they're misleading. Not purposely, of course, but just misleading because we're always interested in timelines, what happened before and what's happening now. If you look at the smaller vessels, and many people, of course, are focusing their attention, in fact, on smaller vessels, we see that the net revenue per day on ground fish trips in 2007, let's go with the upper line, and that figure to the left, smaller vessels. Well, let's say that net revenue per day was created by smaller vessels fishing on average 100 days because it was days at sea management, and they had trip limits. Okay, now we go to the future, 2010, the first year of Amendment 16, we see the curve is bending upwards, suggesting that 80 smaller vessels are doing better than they were in 2007. Not much, but they're doing better because the net revenue per day is going up. But maybe they only had 10 trips on average in 2010 with no trip limits. So they could have had a higher revenue per day on those groundfish trips in 2010, but overall their total revenue, net revenue, could have dropped precipitously because they're no longer fishing on days at sea, they're fishing on allocations that could be very, very low.
Right.
So I'm very leery about referencing and seeing data that shows net revenue or any revenue for that matter per day. You see that in that slide 6 and on slide 7. Another question related to this is, I missed your point relative to the title, higher average owner's net revenue. What does that mean?
Can we flip back to that chart that showed the crew share breakdown? It's probably the fourth or fifth slide. Sorry. Okay, that one, number 5. What I mean by that is what's reported, reported in the report is just this part of this crew lay system, the ownership. So this is the actual net revenue on a trip basis, and that gets split between crew and owner. So in the report, we just report just the owner share of that.
I know it's higher average. I didn't know why I said higher average as opposed to a lower average.
I guess it's in reference to the change in 2010 versus the previous years.
Okay.
Yeah. But to your first point, too, and the gentleman next to you asked that same question, we do aggregate up over these vessel size categories, and that's where, and in particular in the 30 to 50 foot category, we see a drop off in aggregate net revenue, and that does reflect a lot the decline in effort, particularly in that category.
Right. You did mention that the Doug in slide 8, aggregate owners' net revenue. Clearly, most information has to be presented in an aggregate way,
right,
which makes it difficult to interpret in terms of evaluating the impacts of first year of Amendment 16 on individual vessels. I know you're giving your best shot, and this is very informative. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
I have a problem with this slide because you list right on it ACE and days at sea purchase as one of the trip costs, but you don't have those numbers and they don't show up anywhere else in your report. this should have a caveat on the slide that says not calculated in this report. I'm really concerned about how the report is going to be portrayed by the public without those necessary numbers. I think the next report that comes out, obviously I'm hoping we'll have the cost of leasing attached to it. And I think that you need to make sure that you also note how much leased fish, how much of the leased fish actually brought in less than what it was leased for.
Right.
It's a really good number for a lot of fishermen. And I'm hoping that you look at that. I also had a question about...
Can I respond to the first thing first? And I mean, that is a good point, and it is clearly laid out in the report what's included in the net revenue analysis. This was just an illustration to make sure everybody understood what's happening. But then secondly, to the leasing value, we don't have the data at that disaggregate enough level to really say that yet. So.
I'm hoping that that's what you're going to
oh, sure.
Will show up. A number on slide 11, I think it would be really helpful to add how many boats in each category landed fish during the 2009 year. A lot of these things show just 2010, and it would be really helpful just to have the last year before the catch shares went into effect.
Right.
So that you can see them.
Yeah, there is information in the report about number of vessels and effort and landings and revenue that you should be able to get a sense of what happened in the years prior. But that's a good point.
We have time for one more question if anyone's got one left.
Slide 11.
Come up with $13.5 million as the value of transfers. And you mentioned that you would have had attributed an average price per pound of each stock. Do you have those? Do you know what those averages were that you utilized?
Right. Yeah, those will be in the report. There'll be estimates of each, a range of value estimates for each stock.
And you determine those based on the SIM module, ACE trading, where the values were placed in? The data?
Right. Right.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Drew. We're going to take a break now, and we'll start again at 10:20.